The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And I am your host, Soraya, as always, and we are joined in studio again by Mr. Peter Robbins. Hello, Peter.
Good evening, Soraya. Good to be back here on beautiful Buffalo Street.
Yes. And you want to move that a little closer to you?
Yep.
There we go. Perfect. And how are you doing?
Good.
Good. You've been working on a new book.
I have, yeah. Almost done. I have it out in about a week.
And this wasn't a plan, was it?
No. In fact, it was the anti-plan of all times. It is a book I would have never wanted to willingly write. It is a very deep criticism of a colleague's work, overwhelmingingly, in a new book on the Rendlesham Forest incident called Incident in the Rendlesham Forest. And yeah, it was... an unusual genesis in that it began as a book review.
Yes.
I had been hired to write by Gary Hazeltine for his terrific magazine that comes out of Yorkshire, England, UFO Truth. And as I began to review a book, I had the almost Kafkaesque experience of seeing my own work and my co-author's work in Left at East Gate repeatedly and methodically presented, always in a distorted or an incomplete manner, and always uncredited, except for the few cases where it was credited to erroneous sources. And in each case, every data point, one that leaves the reader feeling that the work in the book is substandard, or the witness testimony is worth questioning, or my research is fairly second rate.
Wow.
Yeah, not a pleasant experience, but I did it, and it's a book called Deception, and rather than go through any, even a remote criticism of my jumping into the fray to make money, I decided to publish this book at no cost to readers.
Mm.
And in about a week, we'll have a link up on your website.
Mm-hmm.
And it is several hundred pages now, most of which is appendix, a actual research archive you can use and refer to in a number of respects for your own self on your own research on the Rendlesham Forest incident. It'll be illustrated as well. My friend and colleague Colin Andrews has written a rather... a very serious epilogue to the book, and it is being published courtesy of Phenomena Magazine in the UK as an online book. Again, that will be downloadable and readable for free starting in about a week.
Nice, nice. How long have you been working on this? I know you mentioned it the last time you were here.
Yeah, several months, which of course is an incredibly brief time for a book, but as a professional writer who works every day, you know, one of the great aphorisms is that writing, despite the romantic notion that people have about it, is 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration, like most jobs.
Right.
However, as you know, as an artist yourself, sometimes the process simply takes over. And I worked on it for a number of weeks on end, somewhat in a state of non-mystical possession. I mean, I was at it 13, 14 hours a day. No music, totally focused, reading, writing, rewriting, fact-checking, refining, editing, and continuing the process repeatedly like a mantra, which is a method to do some of your best work sometimes, no matter what situation compelled you to do it.
And I assume that what really started this off is that the criticism of your work and the way it was treated just really got under your skin.
Well, It was bigger than that, actually. I think I would have responded had it been the work of a colleague that I liked and admired as much as my own. But it first concerned me tremendously because a lot of people potentially are going to be reading this book. Mm-hmm. It had a major respectable publisher. It has. It's out in both countries, here and in the UK. And again, they were going to be coming away with this almost ennui about this other book that is written out of this current book. The fact is, the book that Larry Warren and I wrote, that was originally published in 1997, caused some very selective embarrassment to Her Majesty's government at the time, but major embarrassment. And the fact that it was a bestseller that summer. And I remember one joyous week where it was actually one or two numbers above the then book out by John le Carré, The Tailor of Panama.
Nice.
Oh, man, you live for that stuff, you know. One or two weeks, but
it's there.
All over the UK. Yeah. And I don't know if this was in some way payback. You know, some of your listeners may think this is sour grapes or that I'm over dramatizing or romanticizing the situation. I can assure you I'm not. And I can say, looking right into my microphone at you, you don't have to buy the book to read the book to learn what my argument is. And I hope that many people will read Encounter in the Rendlesham Forest to see that my points are accurate and that it's not personal at all.
And you've, and that's the reason you did all the appendixes with all the information people can just go through and see for themselves.
Yeah. I had thoughts, like most professional writers do, about giving away not just this original manuscript, but several hundred pages that I spent decades collecting along with Larry Warren that are key to understanding aspects of this story. In some cases, make it more human, flesh it out, give you a living timeline. For example, the events, as you know, happened over three consecutive nights in late December 1980. Part of Larry's incident on the third night was right before the thing appeared. There was a tremendous flash of light, and Larry's eyes immediately began to bother him. Hmm. He said toward the end of the night, he could hear it click when he'd blink. His eyes were so dry, and he requested an eye appointment, appropriately. Being the military, it didn't happen overnight. It was several weeks, but it was at Lincoln Heath Eye and Ear Clinic, and there written in the handwriting of the examining physician on Air Force form, I think it's 490, it's in the book, it says OPTI/RET burn EXP, optical retinal burn exposure, which mm-hmm. occurred right there at that moment. And, you know, this level of proof, so to say, is, it's important to see. That happened on February 2nd, I think. Larry called his mother in the States completely against regulations the next day. He wrote her within a few days, I think on the 6th. On the 13th, the HALT memo was written, the memo by the deputy base commander. And less than a week later, his mother responded in her own letter. So we have this remarkable timeline, probably the first written report, certainly that ever got out into civilian hands, of the event. Bing, 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 bing. You know, you see the true story starting so early in the military and the human documentation. And again, that's a small sample of what we're essentially giving away to interested readers. I've just had it with certain aspects of the dialogue, the argument, the discussion that I think are holding us back. And I hope that people reading this book will open that dialogue wide open.
Okay. And how long is the actual text of it?
It's coming in at, in terms of book pages, I think it'd be close to 100 pages, okay. But they're typewriter format pages for the book. So I think it's 70-odd pages, 70, 80 pages, and then several hundred pages of inclusions.
Wow.
Yeah. It's quirky.
And we'll be doing a video interview with you on this once it comes out.
Indeed.
And so we can, you know, actually have some visual aids.
Yeah.
And the next time you're on, we'll probably talk about it in a few months and see what kind of reaction you've
Absolutely.
Had to it
and I'm
like
really
that.
Hoping that a lot of your readers, your listeners, ironically, especially ones who may be into, you know, listen to your show for other reasons than UFOs, paranormal, music, whatever, that if they've never really picked up and read a UFO book, this might not be a bad one to start on. In fact, it is probably more John le Carré than E.T. But it's important, again, to understand the dynamics behind the way this functions and ridicule rears its head to, and not just ridicule, but this pattern of deception woven into this book that was so disturbing to me that I'm essentially putting my reputation on.
All right. Well, awesome. And yeah, that link will be up on our site as soon as you release it. And, you know, and the whole ridicule thing, you see it with anything that's not mainstream. It just, there's such a well-organized method of marginalizing stuff.
Yeah.
I mentioned to you David Politis. I got David Politis coming back on this summer, and he was attacked on Amazon by somebody. And the attacks were very personal, and they use certain techniques that I think are very specific to debunkers.
Mm.
And this person never told anyone who they were. For instance, they talked about the Dennis Martin disappearance. I don't know if you're familiar, but
no,
Dennis Martin was a kid who just disappeared, and he's never been found.
Eesh.
And it's been in a lot of books under strange disappearances because it's a really mysterious disappearance. And this guy had come across and said, well, you know, he probably fell down a mine. And David Politis says all the mines were sealed shut. And in the book, David Politis talks about how all the search and rescue people said all these mines have been sealed for years. Well, some anonymous friend of this guy told him they weren't. So he then decides, well, simple, he fell down a mine. And you take that, you go, okay, so David Politis did all this work to verify all this. You've thrown something out there that can't be verified and said it in a very eloquent
yes.
way.
Well, that's a big part of it. Presentation in our culture is tremendously important, needless to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
What happened, to briefly give you an idea of some of these data points of deception, the author of record, the main author of the three, Nick Pope, would introduce the idea that Larry Warren had said that he had seen a cloudbuster on the base, information only available in our book, No Other Source, but then ends up dismissing it as a rumor and Larry being the only person that ever referenced it in the story, although it had nothing to do with the UFO story.
Right.
Where, in fact, the pages in Left at Eastgate that cover that story clearly talk about our finding and interviewing two retired Air Force sergeants who were stationed at Woodbridge and at Bentwaters within 2 years of Larry, a married couple who served together on the Twin Base Complex, who also clearly remembered seeing an apparatus that could not be described in any other way at the same location a year, 2 years after the fact, and not mentioning that reference, even though the author knew it was there because it was the only place he could have drawn it from. By the same token, saying that there was a rumor of a suicide of a young airman who couldn't adjust to what they had seen that night, who was in this case specifically theologically challenged as a fundamentalist kid from the South, and that a former chief of staff of the Ministry of Defense who enters strongly into the story and ended up being one of Larry's and my most staunch supporters in the UK, Lord Peter Hill Norton, that he was so concerned about this that he went and spoke in Parliament in open session, asking the question to then Secretary for Defense, completely ignoring the fact that this wasn't a rumor. The story only came from one source. And when you read the account in Left at Eastgate, you learn that this was not only Larry Warren once again supplying the information, but that this kid had been his roommate, and that he had been a first responder to the suicide, and that it was one of the things that radicalized him in terms of being an activist on this story. Hmm. Again, the reference was there to the fact that Hill Norton learned about it from Larry and no one else. And we spoke with Hill Norton. Anyway, you get the idea, yeah, but it's yeah. one point after another, and again, worded very elegantly and almost always with this infuriating, for me, sympathy for my co-author as being the loose cannon in this thing, and setting up the impression as you read on, never knowing, because there's no index in the book. I mean, I'm sorry, there's an index. There's no footnoting, so you have to right. take the author's word for sources straight through, and this is a problem when the sources are incorrect.
Yeah.
Or well, not given.
It's, you know, much easier to have incorrect sources if you don't footnote them. Not that most people will track them down anyway, but it makes it much harder to do.
Yeah. But when you write nonfiction, there is a certain gravitas on the author if they cannot either supply references as they go or in a more formal index to have established good enough character that the reader can say, I followed this person's work for years. I think they're ethical. If there's a problem here, I'm imagining it's not intentional. People make errors,
sure,
even when you
sure.
fact check. This is not that. This is decidedly not that.
Mm.
So anyway, we will pick this up in our next show for sure.
Yes, yes. And like I said, we'll do that video interview as well, so yeah, we can have some visual aids in the whole thing.
Indeed.
All right, so let's see. Let's play this real quick, and then we'll get into more on Wilhelm Reich.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
You're listening to Where Did the Road Go? Our guest is Peter Robbins tonight. If you have questions for Peter, you can also go into the chat room at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And you had just mentioned Jimmy Church. And what I find funny is that he had you on his show, which I forget the name of. Okay. And he had you on, I think, the same week I had you here last time.
That's right.
And then you were on his show again this week briefly.
Yeah.
The same week I had you on.
We're star-crossed on that.
And although we're dealing with much different topics.
Indeed.
Because have you done a lot of interviews on Wilhelm Reich?
Many.
Okay.
Many.
All right. Because it seems like you're known more from the UFO field than the Wilhelm Reich stuff.
I was involved in Reich's work starting as a teenager. And didn't get involved in UFO studies until my late 20s. So it predates my UFO interest by a decade. And it's something that continues to be a very strong thread in my life, even after all these years.
Okay. I don't fully remember everything we've talked about Reich up to this part. We've done we've done two shows prior to this on Reich, yes, but I do have. Not think we have dealt with the UFO connection.
I don't think so either.
I think we were saving that for as we went, so we could establish more groundwork.
Yeah, and it makes sense because chronologically it came in the last years of his life, and also because Reich's reputation has been so assailed over the decades. I brought in a book last time, newly published by Dr. James DeMeo, in defense of Wilhelm Reich.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brilliant book and one that sets a lot of the really wacky mythology aside and shows it for the nonsense and the specious crap that it really is.
I had actually heard an interview, I think it was on Skeptico, on someone who was talking. He was a very anti-Freud psychologist, and he was tearing apart a lot of where Freud got his evidence from. And his theories and how they weren't actually backed up or they failed, but people don't know that they failed. And he got up and he mentioned something about Reich and just referred to him as, you know, a loon or a crazy man or something like that, and then went on. And I was kind of like, have you actually looked at Reich?
It's a classic. There are a number of groups who will tell you that Reich went insane. And depending on the group, there's a specific time in his life when it happened. The Freudians, a number of whom that original circle, were not comfortable with Dr. Reich. His theories were well in advance of his time. and who were not pleased that he had Freud's ear to a greater degree than many of them. And from the time that Reich came to Vienna in the early 20s to study medicine, destitute after everything that his family had had was lost in the craziness of the horror and the insanity of World War I, once he had his medical degree, he basically presented to Freud. And at the time, the way you became a psychiatrist was you were accepted by Freud into his circle. You observed him work. You took part in seminars. And at a certain point, you're a psychiatrist. And when Reich and Freud split in 1929, it was the Freudians who were the first to put forward the mythology that Reich was mentally unhinged. Well, their reason to justify his mental illness was that he had left the Freudians. I mean, duh.
And Jung gets that too, but Jung had some very unusual experiences as well that also don't help him in that he used to talk to his guardian angel? I think it was, that Jung would speak with?
Well, there's a wonderful book. It's been out of print forever, but you can find it online. It's called Reich Speaks of Freud. And there's an equivalent archive in the Freud archives of Freud's reminiscences about Reich. But this is a published book. And a few of the things for me are absolutely bloody fascinating. Reich worked in the Freudian method for about 6 years and worked with, as I recall, several hundred patients. And at a certain point, he went to Freud and explained, and there's always a very formal relationship between them, I think one of mutual respect, but it was always Dr. Freud and Dr. Reich when they were together. And what he essentially told him was that after working in his method, he felt that with respect, he had to a degree disagree to with the basic Freudian premise, which was that much, if not most, human neuroses was rooted in sexual pathology, neuroses, sexual problems, stasis, whatever term you want to give it, where what Freud said was, what Reich said was literally all of the neuroses and the longing and the incompletion and the sadness and the neuroses had a sexual basis, which was a bit too much for Freud and more conservative late 1920s Vienna. And they split and went their ways. Freud worked briefly setting up clinics around Germany and to a degree in communist Russia at the invitation of the Soviet Communist Party, their thought being that, okay, the revolution is still young enough and vital enough to accommodate radical theories. And let's say that Dr. Reich can come in and help good Soviet couples working in factories.
This we did talk about.
Yeah, okay, there you go. But his work, as we have discussed in the previous shows, was all about how energy functioned in everything from a paramecium to the creation of a star system and the common functioning principle that runs through it. But as far as UFOs go, Reich had never expressed an interest in this subject. In his writings or in any recorded conversations, once the phenomena really kicked in 1947, until 1953, when I believe that autumn he had guests staying at his home in Rangeley, Maine, and they reported something, an aerial object going over the house that did not match any behavior that we'd associate with a natural object, like a meteor or a comet, or any human-made object. And that autumn, Reich observed UFOs over his property. He had developed a device, I'm trying to remember whether it was in 52 or 53, that came out of a concern that a lot of people in the scientific community were having in the early 50s for nuclear fallout in the event of a cataclysm. And as I recall, that was an idea that he was working with in terms of trying to find a way to deal with it. The experiment veered off in another direction, though. And it produced a result that was both remarkable, extremely positive, and one with tremendous potential for assisting the climate and the weather on this planet. He called it a cloudbuster. And the principle that it operated on, Soraya, is so deceptively simple that most people at the time that even heard about it dismissed it unless they saw it in action. And then, you know, like talking about somebody who has had an experience.
Right, right.
After that, your skepticism tends to move to the side. The principle that it operates under, I can best explain with two childhood examples. One, and I may have gone over these in a previous show, but they're essential to understanding what's going on here. One was, as a kid, in the Boy Scouts. One of the things we learned was if you get a bee sting or an insect sting, if there's running water nearby, you pack some mud on it. Mm-hmm. And it feels better. Now, what's really going on there is that there is living energy in that mud. And it is literally drawing the toxin to the surface. That's the way it works. It's a drawing action. It's a common functioning principle in nature. Another example is, as an adolescent, if I've had like a pimple or something, and I was visiting my wonderful dear Russian Nana, she had a folk remedy that, you know, my sisters and my cousins and I remember, which was very simply cutting a potato in half and holding it to the pimple. It would cause it to, you know, come to crisis sooner, resolve itself, and, you know, your face would clear up. I didn't understand any of this. I just knew that the mud or the cool potato felt nicer than the alternative, and that it did seem to, I mean, it does speed up healing. That's a fact.
Right.
So what Reich was able to do was understanding this, experimenting with different metals at first and an apparatus kind of structure. He designed an apparatus, a machine, incredibly simple, made of long metal pipes that were held together, usually in two rows of maybe four each, over and under. The more sophisticated later ones were trailer mounted. Two of them were driven across country on trailer hitches for field experiments in Arizona in 1954. And the ends of the pipes were affixed to empty industrial BX cable. Most of people know what BX is. It runs through the house. It's the snaky stuff that you can bend to a degree. Industrial BX is the same stuff. It's just got a much wider diameter. And these lengths of pipe would be thrown into a well or a lake or moving water. And the water acts as a grounding or a magnet to create movement in the atmosphere. Now, when he first started experimenting in Maine, his idea was, understanding that this principle is viable, was to aim the pipes due east in the direction of the Atlantic Ocean. What was going on at the time was a drought in that part of South Central Maine. And his thought was, if this device worked, and if he could get it to rain, and the rain was essentially localized, and you could chart it, you know, like with a compass point in the vicinity of where the apparatus was, that'd be a hell of a first field test. And indeed, that is just what happened.
Wow.
And it rained to such a degree that it was really noticeable compared to what was going on in the surrounding
areas.
Which
was still having the drought.
Yes. Now, being a classically trained scientist, everything was logged in, recorded, everything was witnessed. He found that when you work with this device, you have to have tremendous respect for the forces of nature. I mean, imagine somebody with a Yahoo, gung-ho, totally machoed out personality knowing that they could affect the weather. Damn, man, I'm going to really do something here. Make it an extension of ego, not good.
Right, right.
These things are deceptively simple to build and operate, but there have been cases where it's created real problems and that those problems have been identified by specialists in the area. So that's the basic premise. Now, what happened was during this weather modification experiment, the very first phase of it in Maine in 53, that autumn, when he used the apparatus, it attracted what you and I would call UFO activity in the area. Now, could that be a coincidence? Well, of course it could, if it didn't keep happening and happening and happening and happening.
And what was the exact UFO-type activity?
oval, disc-shaped, glowing objects almost always. And I believe the date, and he writes about it very eloquently in the book, his last published book, which was published posthumously in December of 57, a year after he died. But it is all of the weather work and his theories about the UFOs and the interaction with the Cloudbuster. And here's what the story, for some people, they feel, well, this couldn't be. Therefore, this was spun, this was exaggerated, this was falsely testified to, anything other is the case. And that was, I believe the date was October 10th or 11th, that after a great deal of consideration, he decided to see what would happen if he directed the Cloudbuster's aim, for lack of a more descriptive term, directly at one of the UFOs on the horizon. This was something that was repeated a number of times, and in every case, what they documented was one of a number of variations. Either the light in the sky, the object, if you will, would begin to move a little bit erratically. The color would lessen. If it was toward the orange, it might end up white and then fade or leave the scene. And then he'd aim it at another one, and it would behave in a manner that indicated that there was some energetic thing going on.
Interaction.
And that it was not something that was welcome. These things left the scene repeatedly or faded out and disappeared repeatedly.
So it brought them in, but it also made them go away.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. The general activity brought them in. The specific activity made them go away. Now, Reich knew how crazy this would sound to publish, and yet it had happened. And there were so many people at that point in conservative McCarthy America who were looking to bring this man down. The first of many specious, derogatory, inflammatory, libelous articles. And had he sued, we now know on that first article, it might have killed the behavior that killed him, was published in 1947. And it was about, you know, his work relative to human sexuality, that anybody that is fixated on sex has to be some kind of pervert. Remember, this is 1947.
Right, right.
The FDA became very interested in this, and they targeted him as a quack. None of his objects plugged into anything. There was no electricity. There was no gasoline. They were nonsense. They were quackery. Of course, the FDA never bothered to try to replicate the experiments, so...
Right, right. Why would they? They weren't trying to verify whether or not it was true. They were trying to destroy it.
Well, they knew it was not true, yeah. So why insult yourself, yeah, and waste your own time? Again, human hubris and arrogance in situations like this are almost as impressive as the anti-life sentiment behind them, the stinginess of curiosity, the desire to destroy a living, beautiful thing, because you can't tolerate the energy that is associated with it. And if the cloud busting worked, then the world might have to give closer attention to Reich's theories on human neuroses, human misery. And what we're seeing right now, Soraya, in this crazy moment in time, is Reich's technology is used in very small ways by very few people, relatively speaking, but at the same time, we have blown the opportunity to shrink deserts around the world, to create rain where there's been none in many years, decades, if not longer, change entire parts of the globe, slowly but surely using this technology. It works. I've seen it work. I've studied it since I was a teenager, and again, it attracted the interest of UFOs.
And it now occurs to me that the first real attention I gave Reich was because of Andrew Collins. His first book, or not, maybe it's his second book, Alien Energy. He talks in the first section about Wilhelm Reich, about this work, about how it drew in UFOs, Andrew more recently wrote a book called Light Quest, where he talks about how the possibility of UFOs being plasma intelligences.
Right, like a Trevor Ravenscroft theories years ago, the same thing, that they're living bioorganisms. Who am I to say that they're not? And at the same time, very credible, very respected researchers, colleagues of mine, people like Kathleen Martin, have come to feel that the technology is so incredibly advanced that the technology is combined with biology. It's so far beyond even our science fiction dreams of android technology. So who are we to say what is and what isn't? You know, we're only going with what we can document in this discussion, really. So much theoretical.
Yeah. But that was the first one. I had owned one of Reich's books because I knew the name. I had never actually read it at the time. But then I read Andrew's book and was like, I need to find out more about Wilhelm Reich. This is really interesting because Andrew himself did a bunch of infrared photos where you could see UFOs that weren't visible with the naked eye.
Yeah.
There was also, and I know I've mentioned it on this show before, I don't know if I mentioned it to you, there was one of the episodes of UFO Hunters that Bill...
Burns.
Yeah, Bill Burns did. I didn't really like the show, but every once in a while, they would throw out something really interesting.
Yes.
And one of the things they did is they showed this video from a police helicopter that they were shooting in night vision, and they had a UFO following them.
I love it.
That they couldn't see. And they were freaking out because it wasn't visible to the naked eye. But every time they made a turn, the thing, it was like a swirling mass of like it seemed like a mechanical object, but it was just spinning in numerous different directions and following them as it went.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. As you know, we lost dear Jesse Marcel Jr. last year.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time I saw Jess was in Washington a little more than a year ago at the National Press Club. And one of the things that we had talked about some years before when I was working for Roswell and he was an honored speaker there, we had dinner one night and I asked him if he had ever had a UFO sighting because I never asked him. And, you know, here's a man whose life is so tied up with the subject through his dad and his own experiences and living his life on the terms that he did. And he said, yes. In the last months of his finishing off his tour, at least 70 years old, in Iraq as a field surgeon, he was on a night flight on a helicopter across the desert, and they had a major UFO sighting. It was not any military aircraft or anything remotely standard. Everybody agreed that this was one of them, whatever the hell they are.
Interesting. That's one of the things. Sometimes they are going to be military craft. Sometimes they're going to have, because who knows what our government and other governments have that we have no concept of.
Yes.
But it seems like there's about 20 years before we see like the stealth bomber and stuff. It took about 20 years before they actually revealed it. By then, they have other stuff that they're not going to show us.
I think that's a good number to work with, and it may even be more. It's always very sobering to me to think about what is the cutting edge of what has trickled down to us in terms of civilian technology, which is usually something that comes to us in terms of communication device or some kind of high-tech toy. And if that is what we have, and you think about some of the incredible hardware that's available to any civilian with the money right now, and what that indicates may exist, one of my favorite ways to see it is in the Eisenhower administration, possibly the greatest military aircraft designer of the 20th century, Kelly Johnson, who worked for Lockheed at the Skunk Works, developing the cutting edge of flight-oriented apparatus in the 50s, designed a plane to replace the U-2. It was something called the SR-71, better known by the affectionate term of the Blackbird. We now know that these things could hit Mach 3. They could cruise at 100,000 feet or more. They could climb at the rate of 10,000 feet a minute. They were not much more than flying fuel containers. At peak performance, the skin of the apparatus of the plane is not much thicker than a pop can. It was titanium. And it was just this flying gas tank. And in full flight performance, it would look like it was on fire with just flames.
Right. Yeah, I've seen pictures, yeah.
Yeah, that caused a scandal that that picture got out from some, you know, snooty air show. The only reason I bring it up is because that technology was employed no later than early in the Kennedy administration. We had something flying around that went three times the speed of sound that could get up into the edges of the stratosphere. And yet, you know, we still had prop planes hauling a certain amount of consumers, like the beautiful Constellation, before we were, you know, full 707 jets. We may be a lot more than 20 years behind at any given point.
True.
You know, we were just talking briefly before the broadcast about Dragon technology that lets you talk to your computer, which for me is so science fiction. That was something I didn't think that we would see, and now it's available for a modest amount on anybody's computer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or phone or whatever.
Well, that's it. I mean, our phones do more than any sci-fi author ever imagined.
You know,
even
to
a
call
few
them a
decades
phone.
Ago. Yeah, they're not even phones.
Forget about your wrist radio.
Exactly. And eventually there'll be implants, which is a little disturbing to me, honestly.
God, yeah. Hey, just push that spot on your skin.
Yeah. Yeah. Or think something and there it goes.
Yeah.
That won't get out of control. You worry about drunk texting now. What if you're drunk with an implant in your head?
Yeah. No. Harassment is going to hit in a whole nother level.
Yes. Well, I mean, the internet definitely upped that. But, wow. I was just going to ask you something else in the mix of... these triangles, what do you think of them, these triangle craft that people keep seeing?
Well, this goes back now to the 1980s and 90s when they first really made their appearance. The first ones I were aware of were in the fairly early 80s, and all of them were involved in the so-called Westchester overflight.
Hudson Valley area?
Yeah, which is an area in New York State, folks, that's not that far north of Manhattan Island. And the Hudson Valley area in like 83, 82 or so was inundated with these triangles. This is kind of a bedroom community area of New York, but it's also surprisingly rural, being so close to the city with a number of farms and things. And it culminated in an almost day-long public event at whatever the biggest local high school was. I attended it. It was very noteworthy for me for a number of reasons. Number one, because it was witness after local witness getting up on that stage. You know, regular folks, shopkeepers and housewives and farmers and lawyers. And this is early 80s, so a lot of people had big honking VHS cameras, and they were filming these things.
Yeah, there's little doubt there was something flying around.
Yeah. Now, to your question, though, I'm damned if I know. I think we may be dealing with triangles, some of which are ours, some of which are theirs. Mm. They may be completely different apparatuses that operate in totally different ways, but have a similar configuration. I am convinced that we have objects like this, and perhaps that's what we were seeing in that area. Although, again, this is still, in Stanton Friedman's great term, one for the gray box. I don't know. That day, though, is also memorable for me because it was the day that I met Dr. Alan Hynek and the day that I first met Larry Warren, who I then re-met about 3 years later.
Oh, wow.
And, but it was very shortly after he had become public, after being responsible for putting forward the original information, got that Halt document released, and being the most identifiable person with the Rendlesham case. But damned if I know where the triangles really come from, and we're still seeing them.
We're still seeing them, and some of them are so immense. If they are ours, we're way ahead of what they're releasing information-wise.
That size aspect, for me, separates the men from the boys, so to say. It is a line I have yet to cross. I do not believe for a second that we have any technological breakthrough capable of putting something up in the air that's the size of a football field or larger, as quite a number of credible reports from extremely credible witnesses around the world have suggested.
Yeah, well, I've heard people say that they looked up and they thought they were looking at the sky without stars until they realized there was an outline there above them.
Well, the Phoenix Lights case had a damn big triangle involved in it.
Yeah.
And that was one of the consistent observations that, you know, for the naysayers who said it was a bunch of private craft or flares or something, you know, right, flying along in a precision-type triangular shape.
Yeah.
But as it passed over, you couldn't see the stars. Now, that doesn't happen with a V of, you know, small
airplanes.
Exactly.
So now, the government's interest in Reich, I mean, if they had a cloud buster at Rendlesham, I mean, do you think they were actually experimenting with this? What do you think they were doing? And do you think they're still doing it?
Yeah. Well, before I answer that question, let's go back to where we were and kind of complete a part of the story. The field tests in Maine were extremely dramatic. And the rain that seemed to be brought by using this apparatus in a very precise, patient manner, changing the angle of the apparatus every day, drawing more and more to the zenith. In other words, that when the experiment began, the pipes were almost flat out due east. But as time passed, to help create the draw over the exact area, the pipes were continually elevated at intervals and bringing that moist mass of air from over the Atlantic directly over that part of Maine and creating rain. What Reich decided, and his closest colleagues agreed, was that a right and proper field test need to be done so that in future they could point to this apparatus and show that it had so affected the weather in an appropriate region that it would be hard for the orthodox scientific community to dispute the findings. And so they did some research, and they tried to establish what was the, or as much the, driest area of the United States. That'd be a good place to go.
Right.
Death Valley was one, but permits and the like were a problem. And so they leased a site of several acres outside of Tucson, Arizona.
Hmm.
And drove two cloudbusters across country with a small staff and trained operators, and planned to spend several months at that location, and in the process break every existing recorded weather record for that part of the state of Arizona. And not only did they do it, and this is not just, you know, information that's held in the archives of you know, folks who follow Reich's work or the American College of Agronomy or those who keep such records, although they're all published, it created rain in an area where 5 inches had fallen, I think, in 50 years. Before it rained, there was so much moisture in the air, and these are telling details that are multiply documented and witnessed that, for me, underscore the drama of how effective this technology is. After weeks of drawing, the moisture content, concentration in the air, in the area they were working, this was some days before it actually did start to rain, and boy, did it rain. It even snowed at the Tucson airport at Christmas that year, which I don't think had ever happened before. They could see greening in the mountains miles away. They knew for a fact that as they were drawing a much longer distance from the Pacific Ocean of probably close to 1,000 miles and taking a much longer time to create that concentration of moisture in the air, that they could plot cities and towns and locations on a gunsight location from where they were aiming, where it would rain 2 weeks or a week before it got to that area. So here's the deal. A week or so, even a few days before it started to actually rain at the site for the first time after weeks of work, prairie grass spontaneously started to sprout up in the several acres around the site. Seeds that had been dormant in the sand for half a century or more just bloomed. Things like that. And they attracted a great deal of UFO activity in Arizona. Again, all of this multiply witnessed, reported by the papers. Farmers were very interested in this work as well.
Sure.
Yeah. So anyway, relative to the presence of a cloudbuster at RAF Bentwaters in 1980, and now we know 82, 83, I can only make educated guesses here. A lot of people jumped to the most dramatic aspect of what was there because of the UFOs. Well, I don't adhere to that. England has miserable weather a lot of the year. And if you're running an airbase, you want to have the best conditions you can. And if you had an apparatus that had the potential to keep the skies clear around an airbase, you might want to try that out.
Can it work that way?
Yes. Yeah, it can. And when Larry first told me this, the circumstances were a bit ironic. It was February of 1988. We were about to head out to Princeton, New Jersey with Bud Hopkins and I think my old colleague Antonio Junez to do, the four of us, a seminar on UFOs in general and specific relative to Rendlesham for scientists, doctors, and psychiatrists associated with an organization that I was working as a fundraiser for called the American College of Orgonomy, orgonomy being the name of the science of how energy functions, as Reich named it. So we did this presentation, and I think 2 days later, we left for England on our first trip there. And Larry, before we left for the train to get to Princeton from New York City, Larry was going through a fundraising brochure that I had for the college and came upon a photo of a cloudbuster. And he said as casually as this, you know, we had one of these on the base by the flight line. I freaked out. I mean, I got kind of angry at him. You know, you must have mistaken him for something else. And he went right in my face and said, no, this is what I saw. It was just much bigger. It was mounted on a flatbed trailer. It was painted like an olive drab, but it was there. And I came back saying, I'm having trouble believing this. It's just too weird. Anyway, you'd need a well right there. It doesn't work without a water source. He said we had wells all over the base. And a week later, I was walking with him around the base to one well after another, each one with walls built around it, perfect for throwing cables over. Now, a colleague of mine, Dr. James DeMeo, whose laboratory is just outside of Ashland, Oregon, and who has probably done more active cloud busting work around the world to help break droughts, sometimes at the contract, as a contract with a government, European and African governments in particular, that how can I say it? This technology still works brilliantly, but the ridicule factor that is still associated with Reich's work is pretty international. Right. And even after breaking a major drought with student tech people or scientists in the area who he was working with, Jim would still have to sign a non-disclosure agreement because the government of Germany or Eritrea or another country didn't want it to get out that they had used this technology. I guess it's for them, you know, the perception that they're going to have consulted a medium or something and then be attacked.
Right, right.
When in fact, an acknowledgement by a first, second, or even third world country that this technology had worked might be a really valuable thing. But isn't it interesting how ridicule functions at the international political level as well as at the individual level, especially around this subject?
True. And it's, I think people in general are becoming more open-minded to some of these ideas, to some of these things that are out there, because so many people have had experiences themselves, and they don't always talk about. And actually, I should mention, we're actually collecting experiences on the page. We have just posted one on our YouTube of a friend of mine, actually, who had some very unusual experiences revolving around ghosts. And if people have something they want to share, they can contact me. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com, and I'd be willing to record and then talk to you about your experience and then air it, because I think these experiences are important. I think the more people share these things, the more they realize, hey, you know, I had an experience like that. And some people just block them out, too. That's the other thing.
I think you're not only absolutely right, Soraya, but, you know, your show, like a lot of good locally based shows around the country, is an anchor for a growing listenership who, either by experience or because of somebody that they respect, know, care about, who has had an experience and shared it with them in a way that they understood this is truly anomalous and not real. And I don't remember whose quote it is, but I love it. The world is not only stranger than we imagine, it's stranger than we can imagine.
Yes.
But I think also, yes, we're all growing up a bit, and even though it's still happening arithmetically and not geometrically, more and more people are willing to say to themselves, to their friends, to their partners, you know, there is something to this. I've been conditioned like everyone else to not want to talk about it because people wire it up with, you know, mental weirdness or whatever, or cultism or what have you. But there is something to this. And you know what? I saw a great lecture, or I listened to a terrific interview, or I went to a conference, or I read a book, and I am so tired of making believe I'm not interested in this. If you have a problem with it, you know, it's your problem. But you know what? I'd like you to read this book that I just read, or how do you feel about this? In your position or in my position, people will confide things to you, like this project that you're working on right now. And for some people, it's okay to share that account with other people, even under their own name. For other people, it's just the heart of their secret life. It's embarrassing. It's awkward. It's overwhelming.
They just want it to go away.
It's frightening. Because of their background or their education or their cultural history, they may interpret it in a very mystical way or a good versus evil way. We don't know if any of these things, you know, good versus evil is a very relative thing.
True.
If it's not helping us, it's evil, as far as we're concerned. And if it is, great.
When we were talking about the triangles, about them being possibly some of them are, some of them not, when I interviewed Christopher O'Brien, who I'm doing the second part with him next week on his cattle mutilation work, and he had mentioned that, you know, he suspects that a lot of these are done for whatever reason by the government, checking environmental factors or whatever, but then he also has to admit that there are weird cases out there that don't fit a pattern of government. So it's almost like the phenomena, whatever it is mimicking maybe what the actual government, or the government's mimicking the phenomena, or there's some kind of copycat effect.
I think you're probably right, and it's more human beings following the pattern that they see by these anomalous beings to either monitor toxicity in the tissue of animals.
Right.
I think also, you know, Stan Friedman, a font of knowledge and a true pioneer in the field, to paraphrase him, the question is not, are cattle mutilations, crop circles, or UFOs indication of advanced intelligences with highly advanced technology coming from parts unknown? The question is, has one of them ever been?
Yeah.
And if the answer is yes, and the overwhelming amount of evidence suggests that that is a very modest way to state it, then we're still dealing with, you know, depending on your point of view, the biggest story of all time.
Right.
So, you know, one can argue the parameters or the specifics of a certain case or incident, but the phenomenon is very real. And we're stuck with it, whether we like it or not.
That's a good way of putting it. And that's the thing. If you take an honest look at the evidence, there's plenty of evidence for genuine near-death experiences, genuine ghost phenomena, genuine UFOs. It doesn't say necessarily what that is.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think people jump to one extreme or the other. You know, if they see a ghost, it's either that it's a dead person or it's your imagination. And there's no in-between. It could be other things. There could be other things that are causing these phenomena.
That's right.
You know, it could be a recording of something that happened in that area. It could be another intelligence mimicking what we think of as a ghost.
That's right. It's lost in the world of what ifs to a degree.
Yeah, because we can't see it from that side.
Yeah.
When I had, I can't remember. I just drew a blank on his name. He was talking about flying humanoids. And I found the flying humanoid thing very interesting because the cases seemed very genuine. I mean, he researched, he did a lot of work on hunting down these people, and he believed these stories to be true. You have the Mothman that John Keel researched, but they're so different. And we know these aren't real creatures because, I mean, Bigfoot, you could say, well, Bigfoot might be real because there's enough sightings that are consistent.
Hair samples.
Right. And so, yeah, it's still a mystery. It might not be real, but you could believe that it's real because it does fit certain parameters, whereas these things are totally outside of our reality. And I had speculated with him that maybe we don't understand what we're seeing. So our brain, you know, we're seeing something that our brain can't comprehend, so our brain puts a picture on it.
Mm.
And it scares us, so it becomes monstrous.
Yeah.
And it's not what's really there. Because I can't think of another explanation how all these different creatures would be there. They're impractical. They shouldn't exist. I refuse to believe that every single one of them is making up this story.
Like the bar at Star Wars, you know, as far as...
Yeah. It's like you just get this cast of characters, and it's because our brain can't conceive of it. It has nothing to reference.
Well, this is just a favorite tangent of mine in that many of us feel after due diligence and a great deal of research, for me, the benefit of working at the side of Bud Hopkins for so many years and being privy to so many individuals so sincere within a number of key cases, real evidences and multiple witnessing to back up their claims. But I accept at this point that these other intelligences, or some of them, have a certain degree of power over our minds and our thinking, can implant thoughts, or can appear in a way that perhaps is less threatening in their perception of our perception of them.
Right.
Then there's another aspect that's not often discussed, and I came to think about it more and more seriously years ago when I spent years as a crisis intervention volunteer. One of the things that interested me in kind of a dispassionate way was the dynamics of what we call physiological shock. That if you're in a situation where you go into shock, what that means technically, among other things, is auditory exclusion, that your listening is so focused on what you're looking at that if a very loud noise goes off near you, you might not even have a startle reflex.
Right.
Tunnel vision, where you can, you know, you're just looking straight down at the thing. A dump of epinephrine, a dump of adrenaline. The fact that your senses are so hyper sharp, you should remember everything clearly. And yet, if you have a more standard, very terrestrial, all too frequent situation that generates physiological shock, half a dozen of us standing around on the corner outside of this lovely building where the studio is, although hardly in this neighborhood and certainly not at this time of night, and there's a car accident.
Right.
And we're sort of looking at it or in that vicinity. When the police take their reports from the six of us, they will get six different permutations and possibly dramatically different in terms of even the height of a person, the color of their hair, what they were wearing.
Yep.
Is this a function of, well, again, the whole idea of us imposing an image when we can't tolerate the image that we're seeing is another thing. And I wonder sometimes about certain reports in abduction cases where you're seeing a white owl standing on, outside of your window.
Right.
Or another more acceptable vision of what it is you don't want to look directly at and acknowledge is this little gray guy with big eyes and a little slit mouth.
And that could also be the, I mean, because it seems, if I remember right, the number of cases with grays went up after Bubbed Hopkins and Whitley Strieber published Missing Time and Communion, respectively. And you didn't see that rise in countries where those books weren't published.
Yes, and of course, naysayers can explain it in one way, what I observed as being on the inside at the time when those books were published and working directly with Bud, knowing how things were selling and also being privy to Whitley's book being mm-hmm. written before he went public with it and proofreading the book for him as well, was not that this was some stilted statistic caused by the suggestion that these things might happen and people reading about them and saying, gee, maybe that happened to me, as much as, my God, that happened to me.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And now I see that there are two voices, two places, two individuals who will not laugh at me if I were to report it to them.
Well, I'm thinking of the cases that happened after that point. And I don't think it's because they saw the book and made up a case based on that. I think it's that their brain then had a face to put on it, too. You know, if you see something anomalous, suddenly you have a reference point. You have that face on Communion that you saw in the bookstore.
Well, I'll tell you a very interesting thing about that face. When Whitley was looking for a cover artist, Bud found the artist for him. Mm-hmm. In fact, the book Communion is dedicated to Bud, who right. Whitley says very bluntly, who saved my life. He was suicidal at the time, I remember. And the artist did his now world-famous depiction. However, no one has ever reported, including Whitley, another intelligence that looks just like the one in that picture. And over the next months, Bud received dozens and dozens and dozens of letters, and Whitley probably hundreds and maybe ultimately thousands of letters saying, I read your book, or I read Whitley's book, and I, you know, identified this, I saw this, this happened to me. But in every case where somebody wrote about it, said, by the way, the face that I saw looked something like that face or didn't look like that face, and these are the differences. Mm. And so the verification was wonderful. It was like unconsciously making a decision to categorically mislead a witness and having the witness corrected. Right. They don't have noses, you know, stuff like that. So I thought that was fascinating that happened as a blowback.
I read from Whitley fairly recently, or heard him talking about, where he said that face didn't actually look like the one he saw. I mean,
it was a cover for a book.
Yes.
And
yes.
It was brilliant. It stopped people by the hundreds of thousands. That book became an international bestseller.
And if there was ever a smear campaign against anyone, it's been against Whitley Strieber.
Yeah.
I mean, the poor guy has just taken so much abuse from every side, not just from the debunkers, but also from the people who don't like that he's so open-minded about what the phenomena may really be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really unfortunate. I was also hearing, what's his name, scientist in the U.K., does work with dogs and ESP, Sheldrake.
Oh, yes, Rupert Sheldrake.
He was actually, had put out a post saying that he was being attacked in the same way on Wikipedia, that there was an actual functional...
I hate Wikipedia. It should just be vaporized. It's such crap.
It's
anybody can rewrite anything.
Well, true, but there was an organized group going around and changing Wikipedia entries against fringe researchers, you know. So it's one of those things that's happening now.
Yeah. I guess in a way it's an offhanded compliment.
True.
That people are going out of their way and organizing even to discredit.
Yeah.
And when that's all that you really have left to attack the character of the individual.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, it may offer some solace to people who are scared stiff of anything suggesting the unknown. And the topics that you generally discuss and that we discuss here, UFOs, survival of the soul, crop circles, cattle mutilations, they are almost symbolic of our fears of the unknown. I used to joke for years that in Western culture, we have everything over here as a totality, but on this side of the line, are sex, death, and flying saucers. And they are accorded a certain special tippy-toeing around the subject, where in some cultures they're very comfortably and naturally and healthfully incorporated into the body politic, so to say.
And those three things actually have direct connections, where people who have UFO encounters see dead people. And there's the sexual component mixed in, so...
Well, to a degree.
Yeah, it may not be a pleasant sexual component.
Well, that's true,
But it is there.
Yeah.
You're on WVBR FM Ithaca. This is Where Did the Road Go? And we've been talking with Peter Robbins tonight, half about UFOs, half about Wilhelm Reich. And we're almost out of time, and we'll be doing this video with you. On your new book in the next few weeks.
Yes, absolutely. Looking forward to it. We'll do it at my home. I want you to come on over.
Yeah, and so we'll have that up on our YouTube. We have, as I said, our first personal experience video cast, podcast, whatever you want to call it. That's up on the YouTube only. If you want to go watch that, it's only about 10 minutes long. I think it was a really interesting experience. And if you have your own experience you want to talk about, you can stay anonymous too if you want. I just want to, you know, I would just like to collect an array of different experiences that people have, because it'll make other people, I think, more comfortable talking about their experiences. Yes. If there's something else that someone else has already had.
I think it's a great idea, Soraya, and I hope your listeners will respond. One thing I have always found is that the ratio of, let's call them, unusual personal experiences that happen to people is almost always larger than we imagine because of the reticence to come forward.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're in a position that some people regard as trusted or privileged, like I am, and you are, then some people may be willing to say to you, I'll tell you this. But I know other people might think, you know, I'm strange or something. I think it's also very liberating to share something that has you at effect. And you're not alone. You know, the strangest things happen to the nicest and most regulation people. And if you have something that you want to share with Soraya, I hope that you will.
And I have, I'm actually working on a book of the depth of all my experiences, because there's a lot of them, and some of them are very, very strange, and which is one of the reasons I haven't talked about them a lot in the past.
Yeah.
I've talked about a few of them here and there, like seeing the UFO over the lake, I've told you, yeah. And I've mentioned that one on the air here, because to me, that was one of the more normal experiences.
Yeah.
There were a few that it took a while for me to even grasp, because they were so odd, so unusual, and I know they happened. I'm a very level-headed, sober person. Yeah. I don't drink. I don't do drugs. Never have. So the first thing when I have a weird experience is to stop and go, okay, what's going on? What's my state of mind right now?
Yeah.
You know, am I hallucinating? No, I'm not hallucinating. And if I am, it's a really real hallucination. You know, and then the next thing is, okay, what could that be?
Yeah.
You know, like when I saw the UFO, I started running down things, and I'm going, okay, that thing's immense. It can't be a helicopter.
Yes,
there's no
right.
noise. It can't be a plane. It's sitting still, and there's lights spinning around it rapidly. And I'm like, but I can't really tell how big it is because it's up in the air. And then it dropped down behind the trees.
Your
and
logical
I went,
mind just races to try to fill in the blanks. And what you're talking about, I had a similar experience as an adolescent when I had my sighting with my sister that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure, I can't tell you how many dozens and dozens and dozens of people I've spoken to over the past three decades with UFO experiences who described that state that I call the checklist reaction, where you look up or out or wherever and your logical mind goes, not a plane, kite, blimp, helicopter, balloon, strange-shaped cloud, reflection from the ground, bird,
and I think it's important to do that. I mean, that's a very important step. You don't want to just jump to the most out there conclusion.
Yeah.
But sometimes that's what you're left with. It's like, I don't, and I sat there and I didn't say I'm looking at a spaceship. I said,
yeah, exactly.
I don't know what that is. I have no explanation.
That's
I
right.
watched it drop down below the trees toward the lake, and it spanned, I don't know how many trees, but it was immense. And that gave me a size ratio.
Yes.
And I went, wow, that thing's big. It's not just that it's not far away. It's far away and it's huge.
Larry Warren and I described in Left at East Gate watching an unknown drop into the Rendlesham Forest and light up the forest as though there were a celebrating village back there, as though there were 50 or 100 Klieg lights aimed straight up. It was one of the most shattering nights of my life. And at the same time, you know, it exists sort of in a pocket of memory. You share it with people. They comment on it. They don't comment on it. They either relate to it or they don't relate to it. They use it to make you the other or the strange person that shows them that, you know, there are crazy people in the world, or to quietly verify a concern they've had about such things, you being somebody that they perceive as credible and level-headed.
Right. All right. Well, we are about done for tonight. We'll have you back soon on this show, as well as doing the video podcast.
Great.
And The Last Exit for the Lost is up next as we continue our 20th anniversary celebration, because I've been doing that show for 20 years now.
Whoa. This Where's month. Your gold watch?
All right. So we're going to take you out with some Mechanism. And you can always go to www.wheredidtheroadgo.com to see who our upcoming guests are going to be. Access the fully free archive of all the shows we've ever done. The videos are up on YouTube and on Vimeo as well. And this is Bring Back the Sun from Mechanism.